The House Transportation and Regional Governance Policy Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present, and let's see, I'm going to see here if Representative Barr C., would you be willing to approve the minutes? Move the minutes from March 3rd, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes March 3rd be approved.
Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 3rd are approved. Okay, we're going to have to speed through a number of bills today, and the first one is House File 1747, Representative Wagenius. Senator, I think we would, yes, uh-huh. I mean, you have an amendment, too, so that may be, you know, taking care of much of the discussion material. So welcome to the committee, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you.
I'll go ahead and move your bill, House File 1747, and that would be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. And, Representative C., you do have an A1 amendment, so I'm going to move that to get the bill in the shape you'd like to see it. And those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative, please go ahead then and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Last year, I brought you a bill about sewer access charges that specifically said that the Met Council could not impose a new fee on eating establishments just because they were adding outdoor seating, unless the restaurant or coffee shop or whatever was also adding new facilities, new bathrooms, whatever. And the reasons I brought to you last year were pretty simple. One was that the sewer access charge was preventing the expansion of small businesses. We had testimony from a small coffee shop owner who wanted 7 chairs on the sidewalk outside her coffee shop, and the sack charge was so large that it would have made it impossible for her to recoup her costs. And we had a lot of similar testimony. The other reason for the bill was this. We live in Minnesota, where outdoor seating is not a year-round thing. It's a summer thing, maybe a bit more. Moreover, people don't eat outdoors when it's raining. Our sewer system is smartly designed for rain events. That's what we need capacity for. It's not when people are sitting outside eating in the sunshine. Last year, the Met Council opposed the bill, and the Senate opted for a study, which has been done. And actually, nothing really has been changed regarding outdoor seating. And equally important, the underlying problem was not addressed in the study, and that is, are sewer access charges impeding the creation of small businesses or their expansion? The outdoor seating issue is a problem in and of itself, but it's also a symptom of a larger problem, and that is these huge upfront costs for small businesses are getting in the way of small business creation. And so that's why you see the amendment, and I'm grateful for the chair for adding the amendment, which that starts to get at the question of missed opportunity costs and the accompanying loss of revenue from small businesses that aren't created. So with me I'm a representative for those of you who don't know, from both Minneapolis and Ridgefield. And with me is one of my Minneapolis City Council members, Andrew Johnson, He's going to talk to you for a moment and then introduce witnesses, if that would be all right, Madam Chair, unless there are questions for me first.
And Representative, we do have a number of folks, so what we'd like to do is to really keep these very brief, so 2 minutes, and we'll get the sense of the issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, welcome. Give us your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Andrew Johnson. I'm on the Minneapolis City Council and represent Ward 12, and I greatly appreciate the committee taking up this bill today. It's a bipartisan bill that we had before the House and the Senate last year, and it deals with SAC fees specifically for outdoor seating, but overall I just wanted to say SAC fees are oftentimes the single largest fee that a small business will have to pay when trying to open up their doors, oftentimes more than every other government fee combined. And this really hurts our small businesses in the city. I've personally seen businesses that haven't opened because of SAC fees, or where this was an issue that helped them go under, or where they held back on expansion. So it is stifling growth within the business community. I'm glad we have this bill before us about outdoor seating. I think it's probably best to have our small business owners speak for themselves, and wanted to just specifically give them a big thank you, because I know they take a lot of time out of their days from running their business to come down here to testify on this very important measure. And I also hope that I get the opportunity after we hear from Met Council and Metro Cities to respond on some of these points. I've been part of this process watching the task force develop, and can specifically speak to some of their claims as well to help the committee better understand why this is such an important measure to help our business communities and our communities across the city and across the entire metro. So with that, we do have Gail from Blackbird Cafe. Please come on down.
Following her then would be Eric Forsberg, is that correct, and James Brown? Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please give us your name for the record.
Thank you for hearing me today, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Gail Mulner. I own the Blackbird Cafe at 3800 Nicollet Avenue, Minneapolis. I own it with my husband, and in 2011, when we submitted our application for sidewalk seating, we purposefully chose to have under 20 seats because that was the limit where we wouldn't be charged a SAC. And we didn't want to get that we feel it's a penalty, and we didn't want to have that penalization because that price of admission was just not worth the gamble for us for something that was so seasonal. And then over the course of the past 6 years, our experience has been that despite our overall capacity may have increased by adding our sidewalk seating during the summer, we actually don't utilize that outdoor seating as capacity because it's just a transfer of bodies. So if it's a beautiful day out, the sidewalk seats are full, but there are fewer bodies inside the restaurant. That's just been our experience for the past 6 years. And then I did make a little chart. And this chart is a compilation of 6 years of business that I sampled from our busiest days of the year, which would be Saturday and Sunday brunch. And that's for the past 6 years. On the left hand of the chart, I have January, February, March. And then on the right hand of the chart, I have June, July, and August. So it's a sampling of the same really busy shift, Saturday and Sunday brunch, during the winter and then during the summer, which is patio season. So January, February, March, we're still operating at capacity because we have, you know, a certain number of seats in the restaurant. So capacity would be like a full house plus we're on a wait. And it's about 300 guests that we average in a shift on a Saturday or a Sunday brunch. So then May comes around, planters go out on the sidewalk, our furniture goes out on the sidewalk, and we increase by 18 seats. And what actually happens is we're not serving more guests, we're not flushing more toilets, we're not using more water, we're not straining the sewer system. Our numbers, as you can see on this chart, are still the same. We're just merely transferring bodies. So anyway, I just wanted to use that to illustrate that our outdoor seating SAC is a penalty to small businesses because Met Council is making assumptions about our business that isn't really true. Thank you for your time.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Mulner. And Mr. Forsberg? Mr. Brown? Ms. Broder? Mr. Swenson? Ms. Breimeyer? Okay. Well, I think there may be some folks who wish to testify with other information, possibly. I wondered if the Met Council was here to testify.
And Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. The business owners, when we gave them notice of this, it was, I believe, item number 6 on the agenda, and so I believe they were under the impression there would be some leeway, and so that's why you have a number of business owners that we expect will be coming in later on this. So just wanted to...
Well, let's move on. If there are others then that wish to testify on the bill, why don't you come forward, please? Welcome to the committee, and please give us your name for the record, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ned Smith, and I am the MCDS Director of Finance and Revenue for the Metropolitan Council. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. It is good to be before you again. I want to start with a few reminders on the basics of SAC. Namely, SAC is a system that allows us to meet the capacity demands of our customers across the region. Recall the recent example of the metal finisher in Minneapolis that tried to move to Wisconsin but was denied because the treatment system could not handle the additional demand. Because of SAC, they were able to relocate to New Hope with no infrastructure upgrades needed and saved over 100 local jobs. SAC spreads the cost of the system over time across generations. It allows current users of capacity to pay only what is demanded now. Future users pay when future capacity is demanded. This means the system can be built to meet future demands even 40 years out, but does not make the current users pay for the entire upfront cost. SAC works best when all users pay for their share. SAC pays a fixed portion of the debt service every year. If a category of users does not pay for their capacity demanded, all others on the system will. This means if outdoor seating is exempt, libraries, churches, daycare centers, and other small businesses will pay more to cover for this exemption. Actual SAC charged is based on engineering studies of different uses, not on the pipes or fixtures. That is, SAC is based on the people in a business and what they will be doing, not the number of sinks. This is because a bathroom in a restaurant will get much more use than a bathroom in a clothing store. Finally, SAC is based on the busiest possible day of the year. Think of TCF Stadium at the Gopher Badgers game. While the stadium is empty most days of the year, especially in January, the system must be ready for the busiest day of the year, even if it is just one day or 10 days. Likewise, when a restaurant adds outdoor seats, it adds the possibility that all seats will be full inside and out. And I think we certainly see that at outdoor establishments such as an Irish bar on a beautiful 70-degree St. Patrick's Day. Or think of Lord Fletcher's or Maynard's at 5 o'clock on a Sunday when it's 70 degrees out. Those restaurants are full inside and out. If you're adding seats outside, you have the potential for every seat to be full. And that means the system has to be ready for that one event without a backup. The council regularly calls together a task force to hear directly from our customers on how we can improve our service and improve the structure of SAC. MCES partnered with Metro Cities to form a diverse and cross-functional team, including members from the inner core, first ring, and outer suburbs. This includes Andover, Roseville, Apple Valley, St. Louis Park, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnetonka, Brooklyn Park, Cottage Grove, Eden Prairie, and Golden Valley. All of those members voted, including small business, a small business representative from the Minnesota Restaurant Association, as well as a medium business owner from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. That task force voted 10-3 to keep the system in place, including the member of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which voted to continue to charge for outdoor seating. And with that, I will stand for any questions. And again, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Representative Barr. Regina.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, sir.
Ned Smith.
Mr. Smith, I'm just curious, we had someone who testified and shared this graph And I'm curious to know your reaction to the graph. You basically said that the SAC charges are based on usage, and in just looking over this information, it looks like the busiest month they had in February, which would not impact outdoor seating, looks like over and above their normal usage was maybe, I'm guessing, you know, 10 people, and that was not utilizing outdoor seating. So I'm just curious. I thought this was a very effective piece of information with regards to perhaps the lopsidedness of these SAC and SAC charges.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is about usage. So if their usage is high or low, they will get lower monthly charges for the actual flow that comes out of their restaurant. SAC is about the capacity that the restaurant has to be ready to serve. So they may not have met their maximum capacity in this season, but we have to be ready for a day when they do happen to be full inside and out without backing up.
Ms. Wolf, did you wish to testify?
Madam Chair, Wendy Wolf, Metropolitan Council member, and I am the chair of the SAC task force. You might note that they did not pay any SAC for their outdoor seating because currently, actually going back to 2010 when I first got on the Met Council, I led the effort to reduce the SAC on outdoor seating. It used to be the same as indoor seating, one per 10 seats. Now it's one per 40. And so since we round SAC, if you have 19 seats or fewer, you end up getting free patio seating. You're not paying an extra fee. So you can't say that they paid SAC for what they didn't use because they didn't pay any SAC for their outdoor seating. The reason we reduced SAC back in 2010 is because at the higher fee, patios weren't happening. But now we've had a flood of patios since we reduced the fee, and that's brought in actually more SAC because development is happening that was not otherwise going to happen. But if we take SAC down to zero for those patios, you can't make it up in volume, which means that all of the other users have to pay. So every other connection to SAC would have to pay $25 more. Every low-income housing project, every apartment, every house, daycare center, inside seats for restaurants. So if a restaurant had no patios, they would be paying more so that other places could have free patios. If you look at the bill that's actually proposed, when it talks about basing it on the size of the pipe, pipes don't change in restaurants regardless of how big they get. Their pipes, when the plumbers put in the pipes at the beginning, they're oversized for whatever use might happen. So essentially what they're saying is that they want all sizes of patios to be free. Even every rooftop in downtown Minneapolis could now be a free patio, and all the other users would have to make up the cost. Now keep in mind, Minneapolis could already do this because we charge SAC to cities, and then they turn around and charge it to the people who are doing developments and then pay us. If they wanted to exempt patios from SAC, they could do that today, but it would have to be made up by their other users, not by the entire region. This bill would say that every small town that doesn't have outdoor seating has to subsidize the places with large patios. So what it says it's doing and what it's actually doing are not necessarily the same thing. Basing SAC on fixtures is also a bad idea, and we conveyed that as part of the task force, because if you have older restaurants with older restrooms with small stalls for men and multiple stalls for men and women, and they want to add a family restroom that is accessible to disabilities or mothers with small children of the opposite sex or whatever, then we would have to charge businesses for adding that accessibility component. Currently, we don't do that, and we don't want to be the potty police. We want businesses to be able to make convenient restrooms for all of their visitors without us charging them for that. It's about dealing with the cost of what is coming into the system and allocating that fairly. Currently, the task force is doing a research project into the impacts of some ideas that came up with the task force. We're looking at making this better for all businesses, not just a select group of businesses, by looking at gross square footage. And whatever your square footage is when you're built, if you don't change that square footage, then your SAC wouldn't change unless you had a fundamental change in use. We believe that this would make things easier for all businesses and keep the fairness that we already have, but take out the complexity. And we don't want to mess with people when they're remodeling their restaurants. We'd rather just collect the fee when the building is built and then stay out of it after that. So
Ms. Wolf, you're saying you have an active task force that really is trying to look at new ways, be a little creative about how this is approached.
Yes, we are. And so we're waiting for the research to come back, and then after that there would be a public process. I'm hopeful that this research will yield a good way to make SAC better. Then we would take it out to the public in general, not just restaurant owners, but to all of the public to look at if that's something that the region supports, and hopefully make those changes by next January so that they could be in place for the next development year. While we're certainly open to doing the study as requested in the amendment, we don't need to be ordered to do that. And my concern is if you do order us to do that, that we would have to wait until after next session to make those changes, putting them back another year instead of being able to simplify things next January if all goes well. So in summary, we're opposed to the main bill and we're okay with the amendment, but we don't think it's necessary. We'd rather just do the study.
We have a few member questions. Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hausman, for bringing this forward. I'm glad you share a concern about our small businesses. Members, let me tell you why I think this is a hollow argument by the Met Council. The fact of the matter is when you are adding capacity in new buildings or new construction, you are significantly adding to the system. When a restaurant comes in and submits its design, pays its SAC charges, it's based on a seating capacity. We've driven a lot of the patrons out into outside areas because of no smoking laws. And as you see on some of the charts, the daily and monthly peak time seating doesn't change a whole lot, as evidenced by this testifier. But more important, I mean, if you were adding a manufacturing business that was a potato plant, for example, that was washing a lot of fruits and vegetables, you're adding a lot of capacity to the system, and you need to provide in SAC charges the addition for future expansion and needs. But what we're doing here when we add outside dining areas, you're not adding more capacity to the system. The Met Council has a regional system of infrastructure for the sewer. So these customers are just shifting from one location to another. You're not adding more capacity. Is somebody going to be driving outside of the metropolitan region to go to the bathroom?
Is there a question?
Well, the question is you don't really increase capacity because the patrons are just from across the street or elsewhere. That's the point. And, I don't think you can really make the case that adding outside restaurant dining capacity is adding customers. It might be to that location, but they would have been going to the bathroom somewhere else inside the Met Council jurisdiction. So this is just about revenue. It's not about adding more capacity. Plus, if a particular business has more customers, it's going to pay more in its usage fee because it's presumed that every gallon of water that comes through the meter goes down the drain. Thank you.
Right. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, too. I don't think the question by anybody is raised about whether or not we ought to have enough capacity. I think the question has been about just about the dollars and the dollars collected and so forth. So my question revolves around the revenue that I understand for the SAC charges is generally designed for the build-out of the infrastructure and for maintaining it and repairing it. So do you have a certain amount of reserve that you have in place? What kind of resources do you have available for infrastructure today, and how does that relate in theory with your budget?
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We do have a SAC reserve. It is by policy required to be at the five-year average rate of SAC payout, about $39 or $40 million. Right now, our SAC reserve is in the high 40s or low 50s, so we have a little bit of a cushion. But we like to use that for when the recessions happen. From 2006 until 2009, the reserve plummeted from a value of $80 million down to $30 million. So we do like to keep a little cushion so that should development slow down in a recession, we're able to cover that without increasing our SAC fares to the business payers.
Representative Petersburg, follow up?
Yeah, I'm going to follow up. Then and what do you have as anticipated need for either new build-out or in regards to maintenance? I'm sure you have some sort of plan for that as well into the future.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Our infrastructure is valued at $6 to $7 billion of total replacement costs across the entire metropolitan area. In order to upkeep that, we have about $120 million a year of capital spending. Right now, that capital spend is 80% focused on rehabilitation. So that is relining our pipes, reconditioning our plants. So it's not really about build-out anymore. We're only at about a 5% growth rate. 5% of our capital plan goes to expansion, 15% goes to improvements, and the other 80% goes to rehabilitation of the system, so relining old pipes.
Follow-up?
Just one very brief one, which is, if it got to your reserve got to $80 million again, would you ever then revisit your SAC charges and to reevaluate whether or not they're appropriate at the time? And that's my final question, Madam Chair.
Mr. Smith?
We would. What we would primarily focus on are ways that we can hold the SAC rates constant. There's concern that if you lowered the SAC rate, then a guy who opened a pizza restaurant today would be at a disadvantage to the guy that opened it the following year because he got it for cheaper. So, but we would work with our constituents. We would work with the public to figure out what's the best way to work through that.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We reevaluate our SACT every single year as part of our budget process, and we look at long-term trends to try to keep it smooth and not have jarring changes in the fees. But we also, when we build our system, we build it 70 years in advance for the pipes and 20 to 30 for plants. So we put pipes in place many, many years ago that are only now being that some of that capacity is being used today with new development. And it's state law that requires us to charge SAC on all of our ratepayers. If you wish to change that, that's certainly something that the legislature can do. But if you do that, then everybody's wastewater rates would have to go up by 20%, and we don't really think it's fair that existing users should subsidize new development in the region.
All right. Representative Yawakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this quick. I'm glad that you have a task force that is looking at this right now and that you can. It's good to hear that you continually look at it every year because I think it is something that always needs to be reevaluated. My question to Ms. Wolf, just to make sure that I – Ruff, sorry about that, Ms. Ruff.
Wolf.
Wolf. It is Wolf. Okay.
Wolf,
heard a few different ways. Got it. And you mentioned something I had thought of I hadn't really caught before, and I'm glad that you clarified this. I just want to make sure this is correct. You said right now Met Council charges the cities then in turn charge the businesses, so the cities could waive the fee to the outdoor patios if they so chose. So here we have a bill before us from Minneapolis, which was one of the biggest regions in our city, and you're saying that the regional taxpayers would end up paying for any of the improvements on the capital of our sewer lines. So somebody, let's say, somebody in Hopkins that's 2 by 2 miles and doesn't have a lot of, we have older buildings, not a lot of options for rooftop patios, would end up subsidizing a lot of the outdoor patios in Minneapolis.
Precisely.
Ms.
Thank
Wolf.
You.
Yes, it would be helpful perhaps to hear from the city of Minneapolis or other cities that are here as well. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm just curious, you were talking about price increases, I think, Representative Petersburg. Can you tell us what the price increase was for this year and perhaps what the average price increase has been over the past several years?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the current price per SAC is $2,485, and that has been flat since 2014. So we're on our fourth year with no increase to SAC.
Follow up, Ms. Barr.
And could you tell us what the average increase percentage on usage fees that you referenced earlier?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Usage fees have been rising between 2 and 5% over the last 5 years.
Representative Barr.
Yes, thank you. And could you tell us what the increase was for 2017?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The increase in the wastewater rates for 2017 was 5.4% across the region.
Right. Now, if there were some other testifiers, if they've arrived now, we could certainly hear from a couple of them.
Good
So again, if we could just keep the testimony to a couple minutes, and then we may have one or more other testifiers, so we'll wrap up if we can here in the next 5 minutes. Welcome, sir, and please give us your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eric Forsberg. I represent three restaurants in Minneapolis, Devil's Advocate, Dan Kelly's, and Eric the Red, which is located across from U.S. Bank Stadium. So I'm here to testify. With regard to SAC charges, I have a few things I guess I need to address, and we need to clarify with regard to what our outdoor seating and outdoor seating capacity would be. As we've heard, that there is generally a trade-off between business from outdoor seating to indoor seating, and I can speak to that rather clearly. And I think the representative who had mentioned that the trade-off in business, and I actually, when we hear about an example of St. Patrick's Day, which is coming to us very soon and will be a nice day, I actually do own an Irish bar. I also own two other bars that are not Irish bars. And I can tell you on those days, yes, our outdoor seating is busy. We actually get special permits for outdoor seating for those days so that we can add to that capacity. I can also tell you that my two other restaurants have no business at all. It is a trade-off in business. And we've seen that consistently over time for the last several years. What we've looked at with the reduction in fees for outdoor seating, the reduction in fees is really just an indication that we're dealing with bad policy. And we're looking for a compromise on bad policy. And when we make the argument that just because we've reduced the fees, or just because if somebody this year is going to pay more and then next year if we change the policy, somebody's going to pay less, doing bad policy in perpetuity is no policy at all. And what we have seen is that this is really just a supplemental fee that we're adding to a system that is already flawed. We pay plenty of money on our SAC fees already. And we talk about new development versus old development. I redeveloped the old Hubert space across from the stadium. So just keep this in mind. This is a bar that was there since 1982. I actually reduced two stalls in our bathroom so that we can make room for better handicap accessibility. I reduced an entire bar out of that space. So a place that had already been there in doing business for the better part of 30 years, I reduced the amount of water usage that was going to come out of that space. My SAC charge for that space was almost $30,000. In addition to what was already there, a business that was already in existence, and I actually had to pay an additional, it was just over $27,000. That amount of money made it so that I could not do the patio development that we needed to have done in that space. I have the Super Bowl coming. I have a large outdoor space that needs to be developed. That was out of my budget, and I couldn't redevelop it. But now we're having to actually work through an entire season of football in order to be able to make enough money to now do the development and hopefully get it done in time. We all know the contractors don't exactly start tomorrow when you contract with them today. This has been an ongoing problem, and it's something we do need to address. And the excuses that have been made are just excuses. They are just that. I thank you for your time, Adam, and members of the committee.
Thank you, sir. And we'll go on to the next testifier. Would you please introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Molly Broder, and I own neighborhood restaurants in Minneapolis, Broder's Pasta Bar and Terzo. I'm speaking on behalf of my own experience, but also for all the little restaurants that are really wonderful that are going into the neighborhoods. And these people are putting their heart and soul and every single last dime and mortgaging their homes to have these restaurants. And it costs to have to pay $20,000 to $30,000 in SAC charges right from the get-go takes a huge amount of money out of the budget. And in fact, shocks a lot of people because they're planning their restaurant and then they don't know until they go downtown for the permit that they're going to get socked with this, and it really causes a lot of problems. However, once you do it, it's a permanent thing. When you then realize that business is really not what you expected it to be, and you need to do something to bring people in, you kind of go, well, maybe I need to get a patio, because when the weather's beautiful, nobody goes to a restaurant that hasn't got a patio. So you then go and you try to put in a few seats, 20 seats or whatever, 30 seats outside, you get hit again. And you're trying to just stay in business. You know, I really think that that is the way a lot of businesses operate. They're not multi-unit chains. They're mom-and-pop businesses that are trying to come up with this dough. The thing that really is important here is I know that the SAC charges are reduced 75% because for 75% of the year you're not allowed to, you don't have a patio. But even when you have a patio, if it's a beautiful day, everybody's on the patio. And they come to your restaurant, they want to sit on the patio, they don't want to be inside, so you are replacing. Unless you're very busy. I'm not saying that Broder's Pasta Bar has that problem so much, but I do know that my other restaurant does. Also, that's when you have a beautiful day. If you've got rain, if you've got high winds, if it's too hot, you've got to have good air conditioning system because nobody wants to be on the patio. If it's too cold in the evening, nobody wants to be on the patio. So even during that amount of time, you really get very few perfect days for the patio. So I think it's ridiculous to charge extra for people to be able to try to keep their businesses afloat to have a patio.
Thank you very much. Are there others who wish to testify on the bill? Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, is it possible to just address both the point on the city of Minneapolis and the question that was raised on that?
Sure. Yes, please. Please come forward. Please give us your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and I just want to make a couple of brief comments, maybe offer a little perspective that hasn't been discussed, and certainly our organization's perspective on SAC. On the SAC charge. So Metro Cities, representing cities across the seven-county metro area, is very interested in SAC, pays very close attention to SAC policy and changes at the Metropolitan Council, and we have a legislative policy on the issue that speaks to support for fairness in the charge, transparency, equitable treatment of all users, and low SAC rates. Metro Cities' policy on subsidizing or exempting particular uses is that we don't support that generally because it ends up shifting the cost of SAC under other payers. So again, that gets into our organization's policies that all users should be treated equitably. I also want to express some concern about dealing with any kind of changes to SAC policy or the treatment of specific uses, and certainly we do support having the treatment of specific uses, whether it be outdoor seating or any other use, be treated and assessed on a using a technical, scientific, scientifically sound basis. I would express urge caution against statutorily exempting any particular SAC uses. Because, again, this is a user fee that is intended to be cost of service. Again, our organization pays very close attention to that. And having particular uses be exempted in law does set a precedent for going down the road of exempting other uses, and then pretty soon you've got a very big shift in the cost of SAC to other payers. During my tenure at Metro Cities, I probably participated on maybe 6-7 task forces on SAC. And to Representative Joachim's point, we certainly support looking at this issue very regularly. I think any time there is a concern about SAC, it should be weighed and evaluated in depth. There is a current SAC force that has been looking at the outdoor seating issue. Outdoor seating does receive a 75% discount from SAC. The SAC charge, which that was a task force in 2009, that task force is looking at how SAC should be treated generally. And to that point, I just want to add that Metro Cities would support the amendment, although I think we could do it without an amendment, to look at the issues for small businesses because that is a very sensitive issue, and we are always urging the Metropolitan Council to do more, at the very least, on their customer service and outreach to small business. But I think having a more closer look at the issues facing small business and SAC is worth doing, and we would support that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Mr. Johnson, do you want to make some final comments? Representative Wagenius also?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the committee's time today on this. I did want to address specifically this idea of can Minneapolis just subsidize this? I did ask this question to our Public Works Department. There were concerns around the legality of taking a specific utility fee for one user and then applying it across the base. So there's more to be explored on that. I also would like to just mention, if I may, a few things that we heard in the testimony of Met Council that I think differ from my understanding. Specifically, I heard it said by Councilmember Wolf that the first 19 seats were free. My understanding from Mr. Smith during the task force is that actually, if there's any other charges, other SAC charges, that would not be the case. I heard it said that there was outreach as part of the task force. I was a part of seeing, I got a witness on one of the days that task force. My understanding is they did no outreach to businesses. They did have, I believe, one brewery. Summit Brewery was a business member out of their 17 members on the task force, and they had a restaurant association member. I believe the rest were all individuals from the city that specifically, or from different categories of governments that have a depth of experience on SAC. I also wanted to mention, too, when the task force voted, the one direct business owner was not there when they voted to keep things as they were.
And if I'll break in here, we do have one more member that wanted to bring a question. Representative McDonald, did you still have a question?
I did, but Madam Chair, it's actually for someone for the Met Council, just in regards to the gentleman who owns Hubert's. I have a question regarding for them regarding his situation.
Madam Chair.
Right. Yes, Representative Krasnick.
Thank you. And to Councilmember Johnson, I think we want to have clarification for the committee here. You mentioned spreading out the fees of the utilities, which I think may be different than the SAC charges that the city charges. It's my understanding, according to some representatives from the city of Minneapolis, that they could, in fact, waive the SAC charges. So perhaps you could provide the committee the policy from the city of Minneapolis on the SAC charges and to be differentiated from public utilities. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Certainly, Madam Chair. I'm happy to reach out to Public Works and ask them to provide any additional clarification for the committee on that position, but we did have a meeting with, at the time, the Director of Public Works, the chair of our Public Works Committee, and that was a concern expressed that we would not be able to essentially do that with these SAC fees.
Madam Chair, it looks like we need some clarification, so thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. All right, if we could bring up, is it Mr. Shetman then from the Met Council? We have a question for Ms. Wolf. And Representative McDonald, did you want to put your question out?
Yes, thank you. In regards to the gentleman who testified, has the three restaurants, Devil Advocate and the Hubert's and the other one, what was the situation in which, since he reduced the capacity, why he would be charged extra SAC fees? Is that is that a part of your policy, or was it, what was the circumstances regarding that?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the question. Absolutely not. We, of course, wouldn't charge for less capacity demanded. That would be capricious and arbitrary. What we do when a restaurant remodels is we basically redo the determination with a clean slate. So we figure out exactly how many SAC are due for that use, and then we look up our records to see how much we're on record paid for that location. In the case of Eric the Red, it looks like Hubert's had only 1.48 credits on record. So they were charged 8.63 for their new use. There was only 1.48 available from the Hubert's. So there was 7 SAC that was due.
Madam Chair. Ms. Wolf, just very briefly, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that our task force is looking at is if there is a remodel, we would just assume that if you stay within the existing footprint of the building, that there would be no further SAC due. So if this were to happen next year, assuming that everything goes the right way with our study, he would not have owed any SAC. That's part of the changes that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Any follow-up? Representative McDonald?
Yeah, thank you. I hope, Ms. Wolf, you do that. Otherwise, we'll be back here addressing the same situation as to why the kind of an anti-business philosophy, if you ask me. And then looking at my research here, I see that the Lexington, which was closed for many years and one of the stars of Grand Avenue, was charged originally a $67,000 SAC fee for renovation. Seems to be a very disincentive program. Now, I see that settled. They had, that wasn't exactly the amount, but it certainly, he had to go to court and fight that, so according to the research. But maybe you can shed some light on why they were charged originally a $67,000 SAC fee.
Mr. Smith, some clarification?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative McDonald. That is correct. The initial charge was $67,000 for exactly the argument that was just laid out. So we start with what's due for that location, then we back up and see what's paid. In the case of the Lexington, that was grandfathered in because it was so old. So we just needed to get some, everybody knows it's the Lex, but I can't put that on an audit. So we had to get some documented proof of what the restaurant was, where it was located, what the size of the seating area was. Once we had that, we were able to assign a significant amount of credit so that their bill came down. I don't want to quote it. The bill came down significantly. It's an issue of information. If we get enough information on what used to be there, we can issue a lot more credits.
Right. We are going to move on. Unless Representative Wagenius wants to make a very brief comment,
we'll remove Madam Chair, the bill. Thank you all for having this discussion. Last year, the discussion was much the same, and we lost the underlying issue that are the SAC charges affecting small businesses. And if they're affecting them, not creating them, so we don't get the fees, we don't get the revenue to actually pay for the sewers. So that's why I brought the amendment to you. It's very specific. I do hope you adopt it. Because when we had the study last year from Met Council, they I hope you all will read it. All they did was say, well, this is how we figured the fees, and that looks good. They didn't look at the underlying issue of small businesses at all, and they ignored the part of the new proposed statute that says that if a business adds new bathrooms, then this doesn't apply. So with that, Madam Chair, I appreciate the time and that of the committee and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. I will renew my motion that House File 1747 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay?
Aye.
The motion prevails and the bill is on its way.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair. I erroneously referred to Representative Wagenius as Representative Houseman. I apologize for that.
All right. House File 1670 is up next. Representative Sirwas. So, members, unless we can speed through the rest of the bills, we will be back tonight for a hearing, so keep that in mind. Representative Zerwas, welcome, and I'll move your bill, House File 1670, and it will be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. And I see you have an amendment, the A4 amendment, Representative.
Yes,
and I'll move that to get it in the shape that the author wishes. Those in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative, please give us your bill.
Madam Chair and members, I'll go through some of the highlights of House File 1670 in a little bit more expeditious fashion, trying to get your committee back on track. Of course, if there are questions, we can always elaborate. Currently, in the system of fines, fees, state surcharges, and driver's license, fees to get your driver's license back, the driver's license suspension process is really a broken process. The goal of a ticket is to change behavior and to enhance public safety and accountability. In reality, for a lot of people, we end up criminalizing some folks that are in poverty and preventing people from getting to work. So an example, a fine for speeding, if you're 1 mile to 10 miles over the speeding limit, is $40. The state of Minnesota adds a $75 surcharge
onto that ticket, about $65 of that goes to the state general fund. There's also a $12 law library fee that's added to that. Failure to pay just one traffic ticket can lead to a driver's license suspension. And so it's hard to get to work without driving. And so oftentimes, people just drive to keep their jobs. And they end up driving on a suspended license. And that causes more fees to tack up. A driving after suspension ticket is $200. And the state surcharge is $75 again. And the law library fee is another $12. What this bill does is it gives the courts some discretion. Right now, in a case of financial hardship, the court has flexibility in statute and often does provide a reduced criminal penalty in the fine. And they can lower a fine for someone that is in abject poverty and cannot pay it. But there is no flexibility to lower that $75 surcharge. And so one of the things that this bill would do is to lower, provide the ability for a judge to have the discretion in these unique circumstances to lower that $75 surcharge. Right now, like I said, the underlying fine is waivable, or you're able to bring it down, but the surcharge, you cannot. The other portion of this program is it takes a currently successful pilot program that's happening in a few places around the state, and it allows that pilot program to be extended statewide. The pilot program is designed to help people get their license back after suspension by putting those folks on a payment program, but having the return of their license at the front end of that payment program rather than the back end of that payment program. Right now, we're accruing fines and fees for folks for taking away their license, and we're saying, pay all this back, and then you can get your license. Well, meanwhile, they might have to quit a job or lose a job because they can't get that amount up front. So they lose their license, so they can't get their license back, so then they can't get to work, so then they can't get that money to ever pay off that fine and fee. This pilot program has shown great success in the communities that it's being used. It's been operating for 8 years. Over the 8 years that it's been operating, we've recovered $6.4 million in fines and fees from people that otherwise wouldn't have the ability to get to work, to retain their employment, and to make payments on those fees. And so our proposal is to really take that great success in this pilot program and expand that statewide. We also want to streamline the process for license reinstatement for people that proactively pay off their tickets. It becomes kind of a cumbersome process right now to get your driver's license reinstated, and it's not uncommon for someone to pay their fines and fees and think that their driver's license has been reinstated when in fact they haven't navigated government effectively or efficiently enough, and they haven't jumped through enough hoops. And so they've paid their fine and they've paid their fee, but they didn't go then from the courts back to DVS to get their license renewed. They thought just paying their fine would do that. That doesn't make them current. That becomes cumbersome and confusing. We find people that have actually paid their debts to society and paid their fee, but haven't gone through this last step. We want to streamline that process. We want to make government a little bit easier for people to try to navigate. And number four, we want to initiate early intervention and enhanced accountability for people that are driving without a valid license, that are then involved in an accident. We want to take the uniform ticket. We want to reintroduce a crash box onto that ticket for folks that are driving after suspension or after a revocation that get into a collision. And we want that crash box back on the ticket. So if that box is checked, that starts an automatic process where they must appear in court and they must have an early intervention to find out why they're driving without a license in the first place and hopefully get them some early intervention. Those are the four main components of the bill. In respect to, Madam Chair, to the committee's time, I'm going to turn it over to testifiers now, and then we can go into more detail in any section of the bill if there's questions from committee members.
Good explanation there, Representative. So if we can, maybe the comments could be brief. But welcome to the committee, and please give us your name and do proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Susan Siegel, and I'm the city attorney for the city of Minneapolis. Representative Zerwas did an excellent job of summarizing the program. I think just real quickly, from our perspective, talk about particularly the making the driver diversion program permanent and making it statewide. And a bit of it is it's a bit of a misnomer calling it a diversion program, because generally we think of diversion as you're outside the court system and we're not going to charge you and we'll have you, you know, sit in some kind of circle and avoid consequences. What this pilot program has done is it has helped people who are otherwise law-abiding, hard-working individuals who want to be driving legally get out from under crushing fines and fees. And it's so easy for people, average, everyday people, but working at lower-wage jobs to get into this vicious cycle. As Representative Zerwas said, a simple speeding ticket, and all of a sudden you owe $128. And in order to get out from under that $128, you have to be able to go spend any number of hours and more than one trip down to Hennepin County Government Center or one of the suburban courts if you live in Hennepin County, take time off of work, arrange for child care or whatever. It's difficult. It's complicated. And if you don't pay in full and you can't get out from under the surcharge anyhow, and if you don't pay in full in 60 days, then you're at risk of driving after suspension, and so it goes. And what this program has done, it's a voluntary program, first of all. The Department of Public Safety Division of Vehicle Services has to approve this individual and their record for participation. The prosecutor's office has to agree. And largely it's individuals searching this out by themselves or, for example, if they have a public defender, we have a representative here from the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office, will encourage their clients to do this so that they can get lawful. And it's a great program where people are given help in how to manage their finances, to help them set up a payment plan, to pay off what is often thousands of dollars, and it succeeded in collecting that money. Unfortunately, just a very small piece of this is what Minneapolis has seen so far. But instead of creating a huge disincentive to be lawful, it helps people really become the law-abiding, insurance-carrying, valid driver's license holding individuals that they want to be and that we all want them to be. So I would just, I thank you all for considering this. I applaud Representative Zerwas for his excellent work on this bill. Happy to answer questions, but we urge, this is a win-win-win. It's been an eight-year pilot, and it's really proven its validity and its worth. And again, it's a voluntary program, so no jurisdiction is required to participate if they do not want to.
Thank you, Ms. Siegel. And Representative, did you have other testifiers?
I think there are a few, Madam Chair, and I guess if people want to testify, my request is just that we help the committee stay on task and
that'd be great.
Be available for questions.
Okay. Would you, welcome to the committee, and please give us your name for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hazzi, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, MACDL. We have private and public criminal defense representatives or attorneys across the state. I want to just quickly briefly touch on a part of the bill that Susan Siegel did not touch on. Representative Zerwas mentioned it, but that's this issue that we see currently with the system as is the payables. Representative Zerwas didn't call that, but you may or may not know that most of these offenses are what we call payables, meaning you can either send in your money, and when you do so, you plead guilty, and that's your you just pay the fines that way. You don't have to appear in court. If you don't have the money, or if you're really struggling and you're worried about the next mortgage payment or food payment, you may not get to paying that. It might go in the drawer. And then criminal defense attorneys, what they see is that they end up meeting with people when it's really too late, when they've got hundreds or even thousands of fines and fees accumulated, because these are, if you don't pay the first taillight out and then you get pulled over, then you get a suspension. And then if you get pulled over again, you get another one, so they accumulate. And the MACDL supports this bill because it really helps get people to be held accountable, but also gives them an opportunity to talk to a judge, talk about the different options for fee reduction, for driver diversion program. It also allows the victim to be there. Let me back. Just one piece of the bill is this crash box, which Representative Ross already mentioned. If somebody has a suspended or revoked license, they get in a property or a personal damage, personal injury type accident, then they have to appear in court, and we fully support that for that accountability and a chance to get right. And then the other part is just sections 5 and 6 provide some language on the ticket that tells you a little more about you may have the opportunity for fee waiver or diversion. With that, thank you very much for your time, and thank you, Representative Ross, for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Hasse. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please give us your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Amy Tudor, and I'm a social worker with Three Rivers Community Action Agency in Faribault, Minnesota. I work as a family advocate and a case manager with low-income families. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. I work with many single families who are living in poverty. These parents work low-wage jobs, take care of their children, and try to stay on top of the day-to-day tasks that this requires. That includes getting to and from work, the grocery store, running errands, doctor's visits, school events, appointments, and the like. If they are lucky, all of these places are within a mile or two of their home. More than likely, they're not. If they have a car and a valid driver's license, this is doable. If they don't, life becomes much more difficult. The families that I work with are very similar to you and I. The only difference is that they are living below the poverty line and trying to get by on an extremely low budget with minimal support. Just like you and I, sometimes they get pulled over for minor traffic violations, such as a broken taillight. But with limited income, they wind up with a traffic ticket that they cannot afford to pay. They are faced with a difficult choice: to pay for their rent and other basic needs, or to pay for this traffic ticket. Like many good parents, they are going to choose to keep a roof over their kids' heads and put food on the table at the risk of having their license suspended for unpaid traffic tickets. To be clear, this is not a choice that they are comfortable with, and this is not a choice that they make easily. But at the end of the month, after rent, groceries, and utilities are paid, there is simply not enough money left over to cover a $40 traffic fine along with an added $75 surcharge. Over time, accrued fines and fees result in a debt load that they cannot climb out of, not because of DUIs or car accidents, but because they were driving out of necessity, with suspended or revoked licenses as a result of unpaid fines, in order to keep up with their daily responsibilities. For those living below the poverty line, this is an amount that they cannot imagine ever having in hand at one time. They're in a difficult position. They want to stay in compliance with the laws, but they are also living in the reality that means that they cannot get unburied from the debt, and they can't get by without driving. Fortunately, I work in a county that offers the driver diversion program. I currently have two clients who are using this program. When my clients discovered that they could have their driver's license reinstated while also paying off their traffic fines and fees, little by little, they jumped at the chance to participate. After getting approved for the program and completing the required class, I had one client come into my office with a huge smile on her face saying, "This is such a huge load off my shoulders." She is a single mother, and after months of taking the bus to the grocery store, lining up rides to and from work, and paying high cab fares to get to monthly doctor appointments, my client is now driving, and she is paying off her debt. While this program has shown to be an effective tool for my clients, there are improvements that could make it even better. First, because it is only a pilot, the payment plans are limited to 18 months. This means that in order to pay off accrued debt in that limited time frame, a person who owes $3,500 in unpaid fines and fees must pay $195 a month in order to get the amount paid off in full.
When Ms. Tudor, yes, and I think we haven't seen any opposition or heard of any opposition, so and we're trying to move our schedule along. We appreciate your testimony very, very much.
Thank you very much for your time. I just ask that you vote yes on this bill on behalf of all of my clients who wanted to say thank you for the opportunity to be a part of the
And DDP we appreciate program. You being here today. Thank you. All right. Is there any other final questions or comments? Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Representative Zerwatz for bringing this forward. I think it's a really good bill. And I'm sorry I didn't catch this earlier, and I may be wrong. It might just be I'm not sure how close to grammar or drafting sticks, but on the A4 amendment on line 1.4, when I was adding it into lines 4.13 in the underlying bill, should there be another comma after commissioner? Is it a parenthetical statement?
I'm sorry, I don't, Mr. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I believe you're correct. A comma in that position would be appropriate.
Hey, can we just move that as an oral amendment, or do you just take care of that?
Well, I don't know. Well, let's move the oral amendment.
I move that a comma be placed on the A4 amendment on lines 1.4 after the word commissioner.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Oral amendments adopted. Right. Then I'm going to go ahead and move my motion that House File 1670 as amended be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative, for being with us. And House File 858, Representative Johnson. Representative, what do we owe this? We accept, of course, but Representative, welcome and welcome to the committee, and I'll move your bill. House File 858, I'll move that be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't sure if this committee had a requirement that the first time you present the bill in this committee to bring to reach or not, so I decided I should do that anyway.
Wow, that's interesting. I think that's a little bit different interpretation of the custom, so we're fine with that. All right, Representative Johnson, I see you have two amendments, the A1 and the A2, so I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you want it. Those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I will also move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you wish. So those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So, Representative Johnson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. This bill deals with the registration of commercial use of drones or unmanned aircraft. And to speed up and save time, I'm going to have Eric Rudine from MnDOT explain the bill.
Very good. Mr. Rudine, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. And current law requires that all aircraft in the state of Minnesota be registered. And the minimum registration fee that we can charge is currently $100. This bill creates a new definition for unmanned aircraft, which are referred to as drones, and provides an annual registration fee of $25. So just to reiterate that, the bill actually reduces the annual registration fee that we're charging from $100 down to $25. And the bill, as amended now, specifically exempts drones that are used for recreational purposes from registration requirements. There's been a rapid increase in the use of drones in Minnesota, causing the potential for mid-air collisions or other incidents. There are currently about 200 drones registered in the state, but we expect that number to increase dramatically as the number of drones increases. In fact, it's expected that the number of drones will outnumber the number of manned aircraft that we have in the state. So that's why we believe this legislation is important, and appreciate your support, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on the bill? Anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? Okay. Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 858, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee Member.
Thanks, Johnson.
Thank you. And Representative Howe, you're up next. House File 1224.
That was the best bill yet, especially when I use drones in my business.
Welcome to committee, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'll go ahead and move your bill, House File 1224, and that'll be re-referred to the General Register.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, what this does is actually, it's a conformity bill, is what it really is, and it helps bring our Head Start language, our requirement for Head Start buses into compliance with some of the federal requirements. And instead of me stumbling through this, I'll let Lieutenant Brian Rue, go through it. So.
Very good. Welcome, Lieutenant Rue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Brian Rue, State Patrol, Office of People Transportation. So, like Representative Howell said, the first part of this bill is to kind of clean up the language for the Head Start definition in state statute. Currently, federal requirements for Head Start require the buses, the Head Start vehicles be built to a school bus standard or an allowable alternative vehicle, which by definition is a school bus body and chassis without the eight-way lights and the stop arm. What our Type 3 vehicles are in Minnesota are the passenger vehicles that are used for transporting students. So that would conflict with the federal requirements of requiring them to be built to school bus standards. So that's why we're striking that section. On 1.18, this just clarifies the existing statute states that Head Start buses must be painted a school other than school bus yellow. However, that conflicts with 169.448, I believe, where it says they may be equipped as a school bus. So if they're equipped as a school bus with the eight-way lights and stop arm, then they need to be school bus yellow. So this is just stating that if it's going to be equipped as a school bus, it needs to be the right color. The other sections, as far as the Commissioner of Public Safety prescribes rules for student transportation, the statute currently states that those rules would apply to contractors, providing that their contract specifically calls those rules out. We just feel that the rules should be applied equally to all parties transporting students. And then finally, the Type 3 drivers, like I said, the drivers driving passenger vehicles, this would require them to report to their school district, their transportation provider, the contractor, if they lose their license. Commercial driver's license, drivers are required to report if they lose their driving privileges to their employer. That was not applied to the non-CDL required drivers, so this is just providing the schools and contractors a little bit of extra protection towards that. And I'm available for any questions on anything, if you have anything more.
Very good, Mr. Rao. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? All right. Seeing none, then, I will renew my motion that House File 1224 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And House File 1037, Representative Vogel. If he is not in the room, then I think we'll move on to Draskowski, Representative Draskowski, House File 1725. Welcome to the committee, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'll move your bill, House File 1725, and that will be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. And please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1725 aims to bring forward a solution for our dairy sector in Minnesota. We have a growing number of situations where small milk haulers who are delivering milk from farm to farm and or from farm to processor are finding themselves accumulating under normal operating conditions with normal manufactured equipment, finding themselves with lots, or at least a troubling number, if you will, of fines from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And so what we have, and I'll let my testifiers go into the details on the numbers, but we have a limitation in statute on the gross weight for these vehicles. And these vehicles, we're talking about the straight trucks, the trucks that are the smaller trucks that have a smaller number of axles that deliver milk from farm to the processing plant, who are in this situation. So what we do in the bill, similar to Madam Chair, what we had until it expired in 2014, is we provide a 10% exemption from the current law for these trucks, and I'm told that it did work well until that exemption authority evaporated, or what's the word I'm looking for?
Expired.
Thank you. Till that authority expired in 2014, it worked well. So you can read the bill. It's a pretty simple bill there. It makes it subject to the local bridge limits and the requirements or recommendations of manufacturers for the trucks, and also it's one of my pet peeves, tells the department to come back with a study and analysis about those areas that might be the most targeted or needy bridges that might need to be properly addressed down the road. So it helps us bring the solution around even full circle, Madam Chair, so that in the future we will have, for local road authorities and the industry generally, a better understanding of which bridges are the ones that we really need to focus on to make it even safer for these trucks.
Representative, you have several testifiers, I see.
I do. So, Mr. Shostrom from the Minnesota Milk Producers.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Luca Shostrom, as he said, Executive Director of Minnesota Milk Producers Association.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. I represent the 3,200 dairy farmers in the state of Minnesota. All of them have a milk truck visit them every day or every other day, and the same amount of milk is going to be produced and brought to the processing plant, whether we allow it to do it in one truck, a million trucks, or 10 million trucks. One way or another, we need to get these trucks to the milk plant for food safety rules. We also have a representative here from First District Association. That's our largest member cooperative in the state of Minnesota, and I'll let Chuck introduce himself in just a bit. I guess I'll just add that one of the inconsistencies we have in the state of Minnesota that I think that this law clears up, if you race yourself as a milk truck driver to the scale house, you have a 10% overage already. So it's legal to be 10% over. But if you get caught on the road, so maybe it's an incentive to go faster. If you get caught on the road, you have to comply to the actual weight limits. So I'll just be brief and I'll wait for your questions. And Mr. Nelson can join us up here. Mr. Nelson oversees many things with First District Association, but their transportation and logistics is kind of his department.
Thank you, Mr. Shostrom. Welcome, Mr. Nelson. Please give us your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chuck Nelson, First District Association. Madam Chair, thank you, committee. As stated, I manage all the traffic and logistics at First District. First District represents 900 dairy farms in the state of Minnesota. As Mr. Solstrom stated, Minnesota is looking at about 3,200 dairy farms right now, so that gives you a little bit of perspective on that. We currently handle about 140 loads of milk a day. 7 days a week. As you know, cows don't stop milking on Christmas Day. All of our milk is hauled by independent contractors. An enormous amount of effort in the past few years has been placed on milk trades, that we call it in the co-op world, where co-ops are working together to put milk into the closest plant possible in an effort of saving miles and transportation. However, even with those efforts, First District right now is currently spending over $1 million a month in transportation costs. We appreciate the efforts here with this bill. Anything that we can do to save transportation costs would be huge. As it pertains to straight trucks, the average dairy farm that many of you may have in your mind right now, there's still a lot of dairy farms that require a straight truck because their approach to the road and their driveway and their yard does not have the ability to handle a tractor trailer semi type unit. Also, farms continue to grow in the state of Minnesota, and if we are picking up farm A that might have two-thirds of a load and farm B that might have a third of a load, it's nice to be able to haul both of them with a full load versus hauling farm A separately to the co-op and farm B separately to the co-op, causing obviously a lot more time and labor. So we would greatly appreciate your efforts on this bill.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And we do have MnDOT wishes to testify. Is that right? Right. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, MnDOT's coming up. Just one other point that was left out. We have kind of a confounding situation here, too, in that the federal government requires that as these milk trucks pick up milk at the farm, once they hook up to the bulk tank, they're forced to unload the entire bulk tank. And so if you have to be in a situation where the truck has enough capacity to hold the entire bulk tank. So it works really kind of in contrary to the limitations we have in statute right now, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nancy Dobenberger. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Engineering Services. So as stated, this bill increases weight limits by 10% for vehicles hauling fluid milk, and requires a study and analysis of post-weight limits to identify deficient bridges. And currently, a 10% increase is allowed during winter months when the frost level is such that the ground, that pavements can support the additional load. So I'm going to touch just briefly on the effect on both bridges and pavements. It's a little different. So for bridges, regardless of whether the increase is in the winter or other seasons, a 10% increase is the same since bridges don't benefit from frost. All bridges in the state have been analyzed for the additional 10% load increase because of this seasonal allowance and have been load posted accordingly. The proposed bill language is in conflict with the federal regulations for interstate highways, such that in order to meet those regulations, the Commissioner of Transportation would need to issue a permit for the 10% increase on the interstates only. MnDOT can go ahead and issue permits for this 10% because the most recent federal legislation, the FAST Act, actually considers fluid milk as a non-divisible load, so it does allow states to permit for that. But in order to be consistent with federal regulations, we would need the bill amended to
allow the Commissioner of Transportation to, or require the Commissioner of Transportation to permit for the interstates. So, and then in regards to the proposed study, MnDOT already has the information being sought. We've identified, mapped all posted bridges and plotted. We have those on a map and also plotted the first processing facilities kind of overlaid on the map, and that's been provided to the milk producers. And we want to note, too, that if a special hauling truck is requested to be analyzed within a certain county or counties, we can go ahead and do that on demand. And, in fact, it'd really be more efficient to handle requests for additional analysis of different trucks or routes specifically on a case-by-case basis. That's what we do. Our permits office works in conjunction with our bridge office to provide that information, and we can do that on demand. So one other thing about bridges, just wanted to note that spreading out the load on additional axles in general will help bridges to perform better under additional weight increases. Now, for pavements, on the other hand, MnDOT has more concern about the bill. As with pavements, it's really all about the axle weight, and this bill would allow 10% more weight per axle. Historically, pavements are designed per what we call the equivalent single axle load, or ESIL as an abbreviation for that. And an ESIL is essentially the amount of damage of any axle weight on the pavement. One ESIL is one single axle loaded to 18,000 pounds. And so any other loaded axles get compared to that standard. And ESILs are not linear. In other words, an increase in ESILs is actually exponential to the fourth power. We call it the fourth power law. It's been a formula around for over 50 years and has been proven for pavements and service to show deterioration. So with that, using this fourth power law in terms of additional load increase per axle, the additional 10%, so a factor of 1.1, when you take that to the fourth power, it's actually 1.46, a little more than that. And so that's it essentially means by raising additional axle weight by 10%, it'll be doing 1.46 times the damage. So essentially almost 50% fewer trips would create the same amount of damage when you increase an axle weight by 10%. And this is based on roads, this formula is based on roads essentially in reasonably good condition, and so when it comes to poorer condition pavements, it even deteriorates faster. So thank you for letting me testify on it, and I will take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Dobenberger. Representative Hornstein?
Thank you very much. All of my math anxiety from junior high school just came rushing back. But, you know, we had a lot of testimony last week on another truck bill related to safety concerns. I know you're talking about engineering, but are there safety concerns, you know, with the additional weights? I know we had some folks from DPS and others talk about that last week. Is this something that you're also worried about?
Ms. Dobenberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. At this time, I'm not necessarily commenting on the safety. I know there have been some studies that have been somewhat conclusive of safety, so I'm not addressing safety at this time as far as this particular bill.
Okay, but just mainly your concerns about the... thank you. Sorry, Madam Chair. Just your concerns about the pavement conditions, and obviously you backed that up pretty well. So, thank you.
Great. Is there anyone else from the audience that wishes to testify? Please come forward. Welcome, and please give us your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with Minnesota Association of Townships. And you heard us testify last week. At the current time, we just are not in a position where we can support weight limit changes, increases to weight limits on the roads. We hope that as we keep working and getting towards a transportation funding bill that will build the infrastructure we need, maybe these types of exemptions will be unnecessary. But at the current time, we're not trying to single anybody out or certainly be anti-dairy. My boss is a former dairy farmer. He wished he could be here today, but he's in D.C. Testifying on other matters with members.
And so we're just simply here to echo what you've heard, the impact on our local roads. You heard the impact on the pavement. There has not been a comprehensive study on the gravel, but I can tell you from every one of our town officers has to go out there and do the regrading and patching of the holes, that the gravel takes as much, if not more, of a beating from any truck that gets overweight. And so it's just a general concern we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, members, Emily Pugh with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm just going to add a little bit to what Mr. Sulem said. So on behalf of AMC and county engineers, we do have concerns with the bill and just overweight trucks generally. Heavier trucks would impose additional economic costs to our counties in terms of further damage to already deteriorating highway infrastructure and additional strain to our aging and deficient bridges. Allowing heavier trucks means we will need to provide even more funding for roads and bridges due to infrastructure damage. And on these additional costs would be borne by all levels of government, including the taxpayer, too. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. All right. I think that concludes. Did you have any wrap-up comments, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The Minnesota dairy industry can really use this bill to help us bring forward a solution that brings, according to a lot of the truck drivers I've talked to, additional safety because, Madam Chair, when your truck is full, rather than the milk sloshing around from front to back, you don't have as much of a safety issue for them braking as you do when it's maybe two-thirds full is what I'm told. Help bring forward a safer situation and one that provides more efficiency for Minnesota dairy industry so it can continue to grow and hopefully prosper.
Thank you, Representative. I'll renew my motion that House File 1725 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No. No.
The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative
Drazkowski.
Representative Vogel, House File 1037.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you can be short and sweet, that'll work for us. I'll move that your bill 1037, House File 1037, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Thank
Please
you.
Present your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is rather a simple bill because it just requires legislative approval of any housing portions of the Metropolitan Council's guide currently known as Thrive 2040 and also gives the legislature the ability to alter the council's affordable lifestyle housing goals and the resulting funding allocations under the Metropolitan Livable Communities Act. The reason this bill is before us is because the housing plan is starting to become more broad in nature, and I think it's important to recognize that it is a taxpayer-supported plan through the grants and so forth. It serves as a scoring device for multiple areas beyond just those grant programs. There's becoming more emphasis, if you read through Thrive 2040, on supporting transit-oriented development. So, again, broadening its scope. It's also being broadened to take things into account such as climate change and beyond that, which is beyond affordable and life cycle housing. And finally, in the document, it says that it wasn't used last time, but this time it will be, and it is more robust than in the past. So it seems like the time that the legislature should get involved because there are the system plans that we've all been familiar with, and now indeed if the housing plan is going to look more like a system plan, then the legislature should really have input as to how that is formulated and passed.
Very good. Are there folks that wish to testify on the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Patricia Nauman again from Metro Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. You've seen me in your committee a few times this year. And part of that is some of the bills that relate to the Metropolitan Council. I think what I would just say is that clearly there's a lot of intersection between local units of government, cities, and the Metropolitan Council. Metro Cities as an organization has several policies related to the Metropolitan Council, including on its housing policy. and including this negotiation and setting of affordable and life cycle housing goals. The concern that Metro Cities would raise with this bill is that cities do negotiate their housing goals with the Metropolitan Council. As an organization, we support fair, open, and equitable process for doing that. We have participated on work groups with the Metropolitan Councils that involve city officials from throughout the region. And we would just have concerns about adding another layer, another governmental layer of approval over these life cycle and affordable housing goals that are set between cities and the regional level of government. And that will conclude my comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Noman. And one other testifier, I see. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas, a local planning assistance manager with the Metropolitan Council. We would also oppose the bill and echo the concerns that Patty Nauman from Metro Cities has raised. In addition, we are also concerned about the legislative approval of our housing plans, especially at this stage of the process. The council, pursuant to our legislative directive, has issued system statements, and local units of government have been underway updating their local comprehensive plans. Many of them, as many of you know, are due at the end of 2018, but we do expect communities to be complete with those plans, or a handful of them at least are coming in the spring of this year. So we're really concerned about the first section of the bill that requires legislative approval related to housing plans and applies that retroactively, given the level of uncertainty that that would inject into the local planning process that communities are currently undertaking. In addition, echoing those concerns that Metro Cities had noted, this bill would propose to interfere in those negotiations with local governments and give the legislature the ability to override those goals that have been negotiated and agreed upon between the council and local governments. The council takes seriously that negotiation process and will be undergoing that process for re-enrollment in the Livable Communities Act program beginning in 2020. So it's unclear what that bill would propose or other than to undermine that negotiation process. In addition, I just want to add some clarity to the Section 3 of the bill, which indicates that which would require legislative approval over the affordable and life cycle housing opportunities amount. It's a small part of the bill, but essentially it's not a grant allocation. It is actually required expenditure for local governments, does not represent any exchange of dollars between the council or any local government, but rather represents the amount a local government should be paying in their community to support affordable and life cycle housing opportunities within their communities. This is an amount that is already defined by statute, and so we're unclear as to what would be accomplished by the proposed bill, given that the definition of how that amount is determined is already in statute. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Ms. Barajas. And Representative Hornstein, a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for the author and then a quick comment. You know, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has a whole bunch of incentives and kind of similar support for affordable housing as the Met Council. Why wouldn't you want the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's plans to be legislatively approved?
Representative Vogel.
Madam Chair, Representative. To me, this takes on a special significance because it's controlling basically all of the communities in the metropolitan area, and whether or not they even choose to participate in the affordable program, which would give them some grants, the first part of this bill says that if the Met Council is going to have a housing plan, that the legislature has to approve this first. So there's different parts of this, and I recognize Met Council will still be involved with some of the standards relative to the second sections, but I do think that it puts an additional burden on every community in the metro area. And as far as negotiating, you know, that's fine, but if indeed it's in that Thrive 2040 and it's written there, my sense is that the cities that may not agree with it are not in truly a equal negotiating position, because what they're trying to do is overcome something that's already there rather than having had input with some authority in back of it. And that's what I feel a legislature can do, is put some authority and some accountability if indeed this housing plan is going to be so significant as these cities come in for their comp plans.
Representative Horn, seems
fine. Well, Madam Chair, it just seems like every time we don't like something the Met Council does, we're having the legislature do it. And maybe we're an elected Met Council now, I mean, or a city council. You know, by statute, we've delegated this to them. And, you know, I just think it's a level of micromanagement that's just completely unnecessary. We had a series of bills last week, you know, where we're overseeing transportation functions. We have another bill today somewhat related to that. So I just think that this is a little bit of an overreach, and we shouldn't be just, again, where does it end, right? I mean, should we be legislatively approving, you know, MnDOT's TIP plan? You know, we could legislatively approve, you know, every single agency's plans, and I just think it's unnecessary, and I oppose this.
Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this is... I don't know if this is a question for Ms. Barajas or for the author. Maybe Ms. Barajas, you had mentioned city's ability to negotiate, and that goes into their comprehensive plan for this year or into the Thrive 2040.
Ms. Barajas.
Madam Chair, Representative, actually this bill talks about affordable and lifestyle housing goals. That is part of the Livable Communities Act re-enrollment process. It's actually separate than the housing need that's identified for comprehensive planning. So different statute in the Metropolitan Land Planning Act directs the council to identify the regional housing need and then what that local need is based on what the regional need is projected out for the next 25 years. That, through a housing work group process, a formula was worked out to figure out. We already knew what the affordable housing need was going to be through 2040, and how that's distributed amongst communities was through a housing work group with Metro Cities participated in, as well as a number of other communities around the region. So there was some variability amongst that. That need is what is part of the local comprehensive plan. The goals are separate. It's kind of confusing, but the goals are separate and part of the Livable Communities Act re-enrollment process.
All right. Representative Yelkin.
Madam Chair, so just so I understand, those goals are separate, but it's also something that the cities can negotiate on. And I bring that up just because Hopkins has successfully negotiated with Met Council. Originally, they had required 12,300 new households by 2040 for us, and we're currently at about 8,700. And we negotiated that down to 10,000. And it's much easier for our smaller local governments to be able to negotiate with a regional body like the Met Council than to come up to the legislature and negotiate, as what Representative Hornstein was saying. Everything they don't like, they seem to be pulling into the state legislature, and it's just adding one more layer for local governments to be able to work and do their job. So I'm as concerned about this as Representative Hornstein is as well.
Very quick follow-up then.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. We do have a process for requesting changes to forecasts, which is related to the affordable housing need for planning purposes, and that's a part we try to do cooperatively with communities, and it's a defined process that we have on our handbook site to share with all local governments. And in addition, we do that regularly throughout the planning process, not just local comprehensive planning, but amendments throughout the 10-year cycle. The affordable housing goals are just once every decade for that re-enrollment period.
Right. Any final comments then, Representative?
Not really, Madam Chair. Said it pretty self-explanatory the way the bill works.
Okay. Then I'll renew my motion that House File 1037 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
And I'm sorry we weren't able to get to several other bills, and we are going to meet after session and after caucus. So later tonight, and watch your emails. And it will be here in this room, so. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you say caucus, are you talking about the Republican caucus, or are you having a caucus after?
Well, I believe that both, don't both bodies have a caucus after session. I'll just say after session. Okay, so after session,
and
after 6 o'clock, we will be meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.